mountains of western Arkansas, where the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, the Guerrilla Media Network presents The Reynolds Reveal, the weekly show that, no matter the limitations that may trammel inquiry elsewhere, sifts and winnows without fear or favor. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and today is Wednesday, January 8th. 2014. We've turned the calendar into a new year. This is episode number 35 of the Reynolds Reveal. I appreciate you for listening in, and yes, we do welcome callers here at the Guerrilla Media Network. The number 218-862-9829. My guests on the last show of 2013 were Jarrah White from Australia, grandson of the Apollo moon hoax theory, and Andrew Johnson of the UK. And we had an out-of-this-world show, but we discussed space travel and exploration. Especially, we looked at the alleged soft landing of the unmanned Chang'e 3 on the moon by the Chinese government. And Jarrah White has since put up an excellent video on YouTube with visuals that match the first 39 minutes of our conversation. And that was very cool. That's a first for the Reynolds Reveal. Okay, now today we're going to turn to the major fraud perpetrated by the government of the United States of America, I fearlessly pronounce, the false flag event of the 20th century known as the terror attacks of 9/11. And we are privileged to have two great people and brilliant analysts of 9/11, Professor Eric Larson and Dr. Judy Wood. Need a lot of introduction to this audience, I suspect. But the basics, she is a PhD engineer, former professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University, and author of Where Did the Towers Go?, the only independent forensic scientific investigation of what happened at the World Trade Center on 9/11, and I proclaim it's already baked into the pie. She will go down in history as by far the, I hope not the only, but the most important research scientist who investigated 9/11, brought out the truth. She's a fearless physical scientist. She solved the mystery of the destruction of the World Trade Center on 9/11 and proved at a minimum, the official story for the big lie that it is, the big lie. Dr. Wood, welcome to the Reynolds Reveal.
Well, thank you for having me on your show, and thanks for the wonderful comments.
Buy the book, Where Did the Towers Go, audience? And you can do that at wheredidthetowersgo.com. Dr. Eric Larson. No, actually, I got to ask him about that. Eric Larson's a retired professor of English emeritus at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, where he taught for over three decades. He's the author of, I may have this count in error, but I believe it's four novels now. Eric will correct me. Non-fiction books like A Nation Gone Blind and The Skull of York. He's also founder of the Oliver Arts and Open Press. And his most recent book, I believe, is The Decline and Fall of the American Nation, which is a novel. And he first came to my attention because he wrote a beautiful foreword to Where Did the Towers Go? Eric Larson, welcome to the Reynolds Reveal. Eric is, we don't have Eric on the line, Pete, but he's standing by on Skype. So
we're going to need him to accept the Skype request if he would.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a practice run with me, and that worked. So I hope it does with him. Gee, that's too bad. I wanted to start with Eric.
If you can drop me his number, I'll give him a call, Dr. Reynolds.
You don't have it? Oh, the landline you're looking for? Okay, I'll type that out for you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. And here it is. Well, Dr. Wood, I was delving into Where Did the Towers Go, a book I know well. And you know what was my favorite thing right now, and I want to get your comment about it, is the story of the 14 firefighters in Stairwell B of the North Tower. And I want to read a little. I read this to my wife, Pat. I'm getting all excited again. And she just, you know, her jaw dropped. So here is, I'm on page 184 of Where Did the Towers Go? And in a way, this is the most human revelation or way to understand what happened in a short anecdote. And here we are with a firefighter, James McGlynn. He's trapped in Stairwell B. And we pick up on the middle of his comment, and he says, I don't know exactly who, but I know he made contact with Chief Visconti. One of the 14 makes contact with the outside world. And McGlynn goes on, the thing was, we were trying to tell them where we were. We just kept telling them we're in the B stairwell. I remember everybody had the same exasperation I did. We must have told them 100 times. B stairwell in the second floor, third floor, fourth floor of the North Tower. I mean, B stairwell, second, third, fourth floor, north of tower, of North Tower. B stairwell, North Tower, where are you? Came the reply. North Tower, stairway B, second, third floor. You could hear they didn't understand where we were. Keep going. My God, why aren't you listening? Then they said, where's the North Tower? That gives me chills. Where's the North Tower? They couldn't find the North Tower. And he, in a minute later, he says, you couldn't understand that, the interrogator says. No, it was unimaginable. Dr. Wood, it's still fantastic, isn't it?
Hey, truly. And when you look at the picture from the outside, then you understand why they didn't know where Tower 1 was. It would seem like these guys were talking from the beyond, because you have this void of a building. It looked like there wasn't anything there at all. These guys are saying they're in Tower 1. Uh-huh, sure.
Right. Yeah, and they were all prepared to die. I mean, they naturally thought they were going to die. And one of the men there in the tower, in the stairway, at one point he says, you know, what happened to the 106 stories above us? They should have killed us. We were looking for steel beams and concrete to collapse on us.
They were waiting to get squashed by it all.
Yeah.
And they looked up and saw blue sky.
Yeah. You know, what's also great about the book is all the forms of evidence that you bring to bear. You don't just look at photos like the September Clues crowd. They say you're looking at all a bunch of fake photos or videos. And all this evidence.
I'd like to insert something else here. Well, I'm thinking of it. They say that I haven't gotten any of the pictures verified or I forgot the word used for that.
Validated.
And I have. I actually have talked to the photographers who are willing to go into court to say that in court. But I don't need to tell the September Clues people the names of these people, because they deserve a life, you know. They don't need to be hounded by truthers. Especially truthers who claim that nobody was killed and various other they deserve protection. But yeah, they have validated the various images. I've talked to quite a few of them. I've talked to people who were there. I've talked to them myself.
Now, continuing on with this segment of the book, there's also, let me see if I can see this. Oh, okay. It's one of the battalion chief, Richard Pisciato. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Pete could correct me. Maybe it's Italian-American. But Pixiato says, I'm looking out on the rubble field. I'm looking out at a big area, almost the size of a football field, and hallelujah, we're out of here. I mean, I got to hurt people, you know, et cetera. And he says, I can see an area, like I said, the size of a football field. And what does that tell us, Dr. Wood?
Yeah, nothing there. But, you know, okay, the opposition would say, oh, here's a fragment of something, so she's wrong. But essentially, nothing there. Nothing like buildings, nothing like a debris pile.
One of the cover stories that you challenge is they shipped all this steel off to China.
Show me the receipts.
Right. Show me any form of evidence. I mean, maybe they could, falsify or forge some receipts, but they don't even have that.
Right, right. Charlie Penn, when he wrote that song about where the towers go, he said, you know, he had the line in there, but I haven't seen the receipts. But how could they ship it away before the dust cleared? You know, in 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah, that was quite a feat. Yeah, and you show pictures, of course, from ground level across a field to the north.
Now, I never say never. You know, I don't say it's impossible, but I need more verification. Like, did they beam it to China instantly? You know, they need to convince me of that if that's what their game plan is. But how could they have shipped it to China in, 10 or 15 minutes?
Well, that raises this whole question to me of where is the refutation of any of the substance of your book? And, you've been vilified to a fairly well more than any other 9/11 researcher, just judging by what I know.
And, well, a few orders of magnitude. A lot of the techniques that they use are, she just presents theories. I don't have a theory. Well, then they make up a theory and assign that to me. So why is somebody working so hard to, using all of their energy to convince people I have a theory so that they can, refute this bogus theory that they invent? They cannot refute what is in my book, which is evidence. And only evidence, and an analysis of that evidence. Are the towers still there? If I stated, I've been there, I could have verified that the towers are gone. Oh, that's a theory. as a forensic scientist, there's no need for theories. Either you know something or you don't. Either you've established something factually or you haven't. You don't base anything on theories. Theories are something you use for modeling something about nature, for predicting something in the future, or something like, the Big Bang theory. That's not a forensic study. If I want to know how tall somebody is, I start with a measuring tape, not a theory. And if I measure, go from the ground to the top of their head and it says 6 feet on the measuring tape, plus or minus whatever error margin you want, that's not a theory. That's evidence.
This whole question of scientific methodology, you've had to preach to the choir and the untutored and do it hard. At the beginning of the book, in your preface, you say, what's the order of crime solving? One, what happened? Yeah, most people would conceive that right away. What happened? Then two, how it happened. That is, by what weapon, or, for example, by what weapon? And then who did it? And then finally we can address, if we care to, why they did it. You don't, in a court of law, in a criminal conviction, you don't even have to do number four. But you have to prove up one, two, and three. And, I'm a little more liberal than you are on this, maybe a little looser in that. I think you could have a kind of a tentative hypothesis and go in, as long as you're not married strictly to it.
That's where the difficulty comes in, because you end up biasing your observations, which shapes your, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the thing about how that works. And this is actually one of the most primary ways it's used to cover up these events. You get people to focus on how it was done. What's it? Well, you haven't defined what it is, but they start arguing. So in order to state how it was done, they have to imagine what it was that got done. Because how do you say how it was done if you haven't defined it? And so they end up solving and working on an imaginary problem. It's not a real problem because they haven't established what the real problem is. They just, you know, imagined what it was that happened, and here's what did it. So if you start out with bombs, well, then you're imagining what data you need that bombs would support. You know, well, if bombs were used, then it had to look like this. So then you imagine what that data will look like. So that's the problem with starting off with a hypothesis.
And then
you go looking for the data to support your pet theory.
Yeah, and your exhaustive presentation of the evidence finds that all these theories are inconsistent with the evidence. For example, you can be you have photos of the face of WFC2, the building across the street in the World Finance Center.
Yep.
And you show a while there was a marble facade that was destroyed. The only other damage to these buildings was windows.
Rounded holes in the windows, and sometimes only the outer pane.
Yes. And in other words, it doesn't show the consequence of debris and carried on a blast wave and a pop marking the whole surface of the building.
Right.
Not
so
there.
Why do we have so many people who, you know, they like to memorize a list of talking points and then insist on what what the evidence should look like? I've heard people talk about, stuff was shot out of there, exploded out of there at 60 miles an hour. 60 miles an hour is not the force of an explosion.
And you aren't, I mean, you're relying on standard evidence about, what is it, in 1 second, 26,000 feet is a blast wave from an explosion of like C4, RDX.
Well, an explosion is, you know, you hear it, it's supersonic. So you should hear, you know, the speed of sound, you know, getting cracked.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you're exploding stuff out, you get a Coke can in the windowsill, that becomes a missile. And people get decapitated. That's why for controlled demolitions, you have people cleared away from the area, and you have other, you know, bibs hanging down over the adjacent buildings to protect them. You remove everything that's nailed down and everything that's not nailed down, and every single thing you can possibly take out of the building, because when those bombs go off, those things that come loose become projectiles, and they take out people. They would make the building across the street, look like it was machine gun fired, and you don't have that evidence. So there was no explosions going off that blew chunks.
You know what's interesting here, and the reason I want to get Eric Larson on the line is that in his book, The Skull of Yorick, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Grave Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11, he is primarily addressing the literati, the public intellectuals, you know, Frank Rich of the New York Times or Amy Goodman of Democracy Now, and a long list of influential thinkers. I'm using that in quotes. And he takes them on for their omission, but infantile comments when they're forced to, if you will, about 9/11. And that it's the establishment media that he concentrates a lot of his firepower at in leading to the hollowing out of America and all the dire consequences of 9/11. Whereas you are really looking at the so-called 9/11 truthers and all the people who are supposedly laboring in the fields to harvest truth about 9/11, and yet they too many of them don't appear to be well-intended, and even those who are may well be mistaken because they aren't good thinkers.
Right. I've often said that there's three things, you know, one or more of them to keep someone from seeing what happened. Number one is problem-solving skills. Number two is groupthink or peer pressure. And the third thing is they're terrified of the implications. But I'm actually coming to see that there's something else that sort of incorporates all of those things. And that is that a lot of people tend to memorize a list of talking points. They don't think. They just absorb in what they're told and react to that. You know, they know the official story is wrong. Well, don't you think those who planned 9/11 would anticipate that and find a place to herd them and steer them? Mm-hmm. So if anyone starts asking questions, you have this truther movement to collect them and give them, you know, if you don't like the lie behind door number one, oh, we'll give you the lie behind door number two.
Yep.
And if you don't like the lie behind door number two, well, oh, look right in here, door number three. Anything to keep them occupied so they don't turn around and see the wide open field of evidence behind them.
I just started reading a book on the JFK assassination. Of course, we just recognized, not celebrated, the 50th anniversary of the assassination in Dallas. And this writer, Dr. Eugene Moore, I haven't gotten that far into the book, but his book is centered on the 50 greatest lies about the JFK assassination. And he makes a comment to the effect, and I think it's true, that too many people go down rabbit holes or look at details that may not be significant. And there's a lot of fog and mist and confusion. And you need to sometimes step back and look at what are the main things that we need to know about this. What do you think about that comment?
Well, I know how the distraction easily works, and that's why I say don't go with a theory or speculation or whatever, because you're already shaping the information. And, you know, don't you think that you would be herded in the wrong direction anyway, you know, if you start following breadcrumb trails? But what I ended up doing is just taking in the data, and you resist. It takes a lot of discipline to resist the temptation to jump to any conclusions. Let the data tell you what happened. You don't tell the data what happened. You don't tell the data what you want it to say. You listen to what the data is telling you. And that is a very important thing to do. Rather, there's a lot of people out there who like to say, oh, I connect the dots. You know, proud of themselves because they're a dot connector. What they're doing is just randomly connecting things, you know, through speculation, and that doesn't give you any reliable information. You can have, you know, suspicions here and there, but that is not, it's so important to listen to what the data is actually saying. And if you get a whole generation of people who don't know how to look at evidence, you can pull anything on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and your work and that discipline, another word for it to me is patience. And I'm not a patient man, I would say.
Everybody wants to jump to the answer.
A lot of Americans aren't. Yet.
Right, but this data, it's a journey to go through the data, and I put it in a particular order in the book to get people realizing things as they go. Like at the beginning, you know, for the hard to deal with folks, there's the billiard ball example that, you know, anyone who goes through that, who's honest, you know, starts saying, oh, wow, there is a problem. There's no denying that. And then I go from there to the jumper chapter, which says, it ain't what you think it is. You know, wipe the slate clean and then they're ready to start looking. Because otherwise, they'd be looking at evidence.
That's one of the things a person has to do is put aside what everybody says and go investigate. Right? Where did the tower go? You're listening to the Reynolds Reveal, and we're about to take a break. So come on back, Dr. Tim Wood, and hopefully, Professor Eric Larson. We are back. We are back on the Reynolds Reveal, and now we have Eric Larson on the line to join and in and make this a three-way conversation to explore basically the cover-up of the truth about 9/11. And I've been reading and almost finished The Skull of Yorick, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Great Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11 by Eric Larson. And Eric, this is
Hello.
This came out in 2011, did it not?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and one of the more amazing references that popped up to me was Amy Goodman of Democracy Now.
Yeah.
Is caught on a videotape on YouTube, and Eric sent me the right links because the one in the book didn't work. But I thought that was amazing. She's there at the WTC 7 event, and I was putting out an email. I said, now it makes sense that she's only broadcasting only a few blocks away at 9 a.m. In downtown New York City. To go over there, I would take a crew, anything I could. I'm a journalist, number one, right? Get it first, get it right. And I'd be there all day furthermore, it's right happening in my neighborhood, the most important event of the young century and maybe the most important event in the life of the American Republic. And yet she apparently denies being there. Why would you do that? I don't know if that's true, but let me have Eric Larson comment on this whole event, because she is one of the journalists or public intellectuals that Eric Larson takes to task for being part of the cover-up. Which has worked very well so far, the cover-up of the truth about what happened on 9/11.
Yes, thanks, Morgan. I'd be happy to talk about this a little bit. I can't by any means pretend to know anything that was going on in Amy Goodman's mind that day or that afternoon or later that afternoon when WTC7 disappeared. But I do know that, maybe I'll come in around the back door in a sense, that in The Skull of Yorick, The Skull of Yorick was pre Where Did the Towers Go? As I was composing these pieces, A Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit. And that book came out in 2006. And as a result of the book, I created a website. And the idea was that I was going to promote the book, but that didn't prove to be working or happening, but instead I began writing. And for the next 3 years, I continued writing and publishing on that website, and almost all of the pieces, not all, but a very great majority of them, were essays written by me on the subject of what was happening to intellectuals in America as a result of their denial of the events and facts of 9/11. So that I would say that the important thing to me about Amy Goodman is that she's proven herself to be an abject hypocrite. The chapter in my book that deals with this matter is what is it called? It's called Amy Goodman, A Mind Prostituted. And so I was so struck by one of her pieces. I didn't tend to listen to the radio much, but her radio, but I listened. I read she began writing essays in print, and I read them every chance, every time they came in my view. And she was writing about Hans and Sophie, what was their name, in the Nazi era, the last name.
I can't recall either.
But. But in any case, it's a great story that they resisted the propaganda of the day, and they were decapitated as a result in punishment. And Amy Goodman, in this essay, the name of which, of course, I would have to look up. I wasn't thinking I was going to talk about this essay, but nevertheless, she argues that what she does and is going to continue to do as a journalist is go in the places where the light isn't shining. That is to say, go in the places where the unseen places. And
we shall not be silent.
That's it.
Is that her cry?
Yeah, that was Sophie and Hans's. Yeah, and they put this on the bottom of, I think, of a broadsheet or a broadside. That was, you know, to show their resistance. Well, in any case, they died. They made the ultimate sacrifice, as it's known. And Amy Goodman was capitalizing on it in a way that suggested that she was doing the same thing as them. Well, she's not doing such a thing at all. I mean, she's whether she's doing it by omission or commission, or whether she's doing it by ignorance or by failure to do her homework, whether she's doing it by a malevolent will, whether she's doing it out of terror of her superiors or fear for keeping up her job, it matters not. The point is, I mean, it matters. Of course it matters in all kinds of different ways. But she remains an abject hypocrite. If she were in 1391, no, I'm sorry, take it back, 1321, Florence, Italy, that's the year that Dante Alighieri died. If she were alive when he was alive, and if she and he were investigating her and putting her down in the Inferno, she'd be in the circle of the hypocrites. Wandering for eternity.
The ninth circle.
You know, the hypocrites didn't come off too badly. They only had to walk around under lead capes for eternity. They didn't have to suffer rains of fire or pits of hot tar. But nevertheless, it was no fun down there. And it never ended. That was, of course, the chief point. Whatever the punishment was. The point of it was, of course, to be symbolically the equivalent, inverse equivalent of the sin. And somehow appropriate to the sin. But whenever I go to the dentist, I have to have that stupid lead apron put on so they can x-ray my teeth without radiating me, presumably. I think of the...
You know, Eric, there's, I find it interesting that you have spent all these many years in New York City. You're part of the local culture. And it always struck me as incredible that the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or so much of American news broadcasting, et cetera, mm-hmm. basically was remain silent, never ask any good questions for the most part, with a few exceptions early on when 9/11 happened and shortly thereafter and the next day. But so you can find exceptions. But it's an incredible thing how, what should we say, how wooden and really insensitive and anti-intellectual the whole establishment there was.
It just and remains. Go ahead.
And remains.
I'd like to add a quote from Dan Rather. He said, kind of on his way out, he said, "You're always caught between doing a good job and doing the right thing." And I think that is quite powerful, because if you think about it, the whole media industry is based on profits. And if you have to worry about pleasing the customers, it's going to shape what you can publish or talk about on the evening news, because your sponsors care if you're popular. So we have popularized news. We don't have real news.
But, you know, from an economist's point of view, if you have a free market with lots of competition and what we that the thing is, in a sense, will take care of itself. People find out what they need to know. They know what they need to know.
Not necessarily.
But now it's almost like a cartel thing where, what is it, six corporations generate 90% of the national, international news in America?
But,
Eric
but
may
I,
know.
But I still think it's still a problem because we have the independent and alternative media people doing the same thing because they are supported by the number of subscribers they have. And if they're not popular, they won't stay around in business. They can't support themselves. And we can name several of them that we've seen do that. They've had me on, but then the truthers tackle them. And so pretty soon they start having truthers on.
You were give that specific example you gave me today. You were on Red Eyes Radio in Denmark.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then they didn't like what you said, or
they did. They didn't mind it at all. And they have a copy of my book. They understand it, but they're listener supported. And if their listeners don't like it, where does that put them?
So they went from Judy Wood and the truth to Neil's Herit and lies about the thermite.
Or it's all opinions. It's all. I guess we'll never know what really happened. And. Yeah. It ends up being this big vague thing. We pretty soon don't have any solid information anymore. It's all pleasing the customer. And you can't blame anyone in particular. You can't blame them. They're trying to stay in business. But it's the culture that we have that's created this, too. That if people can't handle the truth about 9/11, they don't want to hear the truth. They want to hear something else. So it isn't about being able to pick and choose which media, you know, like a free market.
Now, Eric, I think you gave me a different view in your book, The Skull of Yorick, in that you parsed out some numbers saying, well, about 100 million Americans arguably poll evidence or think the government was involved in 9/11 or they reject the official story. And then 200 million are just on the sideline. I call them inert. And then we have about 100,000 or so intellectuals, journalists, opinion makers, the agents of the power elite, however phrased, that are holding back, if you will, or controlling the influence or suppressing the truth and its impact on the 300 million. So I really believe that people can handle the truth, that there is a demand, but it has more to do with a top-down control or suppression than it does a disinterest in the truth. What do you think?
I think that's a huge, huge question. I'm agreeing with both of you and disagreeing at the same time. I don't know quite where to start, but let me go back to what Dr. Wood said just a moment ago, the Dan Rather quote. Sometimes it's difficult to do it. How does it go?
You're always caught between doing a good job and doing the right thing.
Yeah, and exactly. And of course, a good job, well, I just jotted down in my notes here that you could make an analogous ambivalence there or opposition by saying the difference between being a good Nazi and being a resistor. Because
exactly.
Yeah, and so that doing a good job, by that I assume rather to have meant a job that would impress
the popularity.
That would pass muster with his superiors, whereas the right thing would not pass muster with his superiors. And of course, he was indeed fired, was he not, for the very having done that with the typewriter incident.
With George W. Bush.
I think he was set up and got rid of that way.
So then this leads me to question whether is it a top down or a bottom up. Certainly it looks like a top down phenomenon to me. In that when Morgan was asking just a few moments ago about the amazement of New York City intellectuals and certainly journalistic powerhouse that it is, it's just remained stalwartly lying and denying and covering up.
But it's safe. It's safe for maximizing customers.
Right.
And also keeping your supporters, satisfied with what you're doing. You'd have a whole lot of sponsors pull out on you if you didn't keep your customers happy.
Absolutely. But then the point that I was going to make, though, is that that's obvious that there's the top down shackles placed on the subject and on the information. But what about the bottom up? What about the idea that the people get the news that they want If the news is in fact a commodity, and if the driving force is the profit motive, then of course the people won't be given anything that they don't want.
That's what I'm saying. It isn't necessarily top down. It's that top down in terms of profits, but the profits are determined by the pleasure of the audience.
Yes. Yeah, so for most of my adult lifetime, I've heard it said that marketing research and marketers and corporate planning all are concerned with giving the people what they want. And that means giving them garbage, giving them junk, giving them inferior machinery, giving them inferior automobiles, giving them stuff that's going to be planned obsolete, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, is it really true that the people want
that?
They're actually convinced that they want this. I heard an auto designer who said that what they do is they design and build a car, and then they market it and convince people that's what they want.
Yeah.
That kind of producer sovereignty doesn't work compared to consumer sovereignty. Ford doesn't put out the new Fusion with the Aston Martin type styling is a hit. They cannot produce them fast enough, okay? Even though it's arguably not the best midsize sedan, you know, it doesn't have probably not quite as up to Toyota reliability, but there's no way you can keep putting out junk in the normal consumer market and thrive. No, it doesn't work that way. And that's why I'm wondering how it is in the news and intellectual spheres. I see it more as a producer sovereignty issue, but it's because of the concentration and the top down. The same people who, in a sense, own the government. This is highly oversimplified, I know, but the people who own the government own the media. You know, the media, as Joe Keith says, the enforcement arm of the power elite.
Well, it's their marketing department, actually, I think. But there's something that Jesse Ventura said. I have to give credit where credit's due. He brought out that when the news changed, it was with the show 60 Minutes. Before then, the news was like a public service announcement, and TV shows realized they're going to, you know, it was a loss, but it's what they all did for their public service deed. And then 60 Minutes came along, and they realized news was profitable. What the 60 Minutes show showed them, that news was profitable. And then after that, the news became a
Yeah, that was a magazine format and innovative when it and it was a big success.
How long ago was it that it came into being? About
many decades now.
Okay.
Wasn't it in the 60s?
Maybe a beginning of the 70s.
Okay, good. I don't watch it.
I don't know. Somewhere around there.
I just needed to know whether it was 5 years or more, close to 30. Then that's fine.
Yeah, it was a long time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, but, you know, what's amazing to me is, okay, now 9/11 is a relatively recent massive crime for all the gains, all the gift that keeps giving. And yet the same kind of cover up, it's so intense on JFK's assassination.
The
establishment, in a sense, is running scared of the people. And the media is maybe the most scared of all. I mean, I look at my Arkansas newspaper. They can't even run a story raising any questions about JFK's, the conspiracy to murder him and LBJ at the center of it, the whole truth. They're scared.
Something I'd like you to try out, this thinking that it still is consumer driven, I've been interested in this particular writer lately and noticing his works about how people, you know, from the day they're born, what do they hear in this country? America is the greatest nation in the world. And that gets embedded deep, deep, deep in. And so they assume the world, this is the greatest nation in the world. Our government wouldn't allow bad guys to come attack us like this. They'll protect us. This is a belief. It's not a logical thought out, through the evidence. It's just, it's a belief, and that belief goes to their core. you know, much less have our government covered up.
Oh, that's American exceptionalism, and it still is powerful. There's no doubt about it.
And if you get that going on, and with the JFK thing or the moon landing or whatever you're going to question, mm-hmm. you get this, how dare you back. Our government wouldn't do a thing like that. How dare you? There's just immediate resistance. It's not a thought. It's just a reflex.
But there can't be any doubt, can there, that is a reflex or has become a reflex largely because of reinforcement from above through the media. Isn't that like a cat chasing its tail? Can't tell who's chasing who. Am I wrong?
Well, yeah. And most importantly, you have a more and more centralized government school system where it's indoctrination.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So you have it there your whole life with the mass media, and then you started off with it.
I was telling Eric something earlier today about this, you know, in third and fourth grade, we had these weekly readers, you know, it's like a child's newspaper. And there's a story about the big bad Russians who sold propaganda to their citizens. And weren't they horrible? And I raised my hand and said, well, how do we know this isn't propaganda that we're being fed? And the entire class looked at me like I was insane.
The crazy one. Yeah.
Yeah, I was the crazy one for asking that. How dare you?
Yeah.
And that really is one of those memories from childhood that stuck in really deep because mm-hmm. there was just no logic involved there.
I think I don't know. I'm a little concerned. Is there going to be music again? We'll have to take a break. But, you know, I have to confess that I'm still of the view, and maybe not even still of the view, maybe more strongly of the view than ever, that there's only one way out of this kind of circular terror, and that is, of course, truth. Now, if you had been able to just simply assert the truth in the Weekly Reader incident, or if it had been possible for you to reach over and take a book off the shelf that had everyone's respect and contained the truth about the propaganda methods in both nations, and if it had been read impartially by you and the other people, then everybody would have revealed or would have agreed, would they not? That each nation, each grand nation, great nation of that type, each nation trying to hold on to the power that it has, will manipulate its people to whatever ends it can and sees fit as needed.
And as Morgan pointed out, that this who runs the schools?
No. I'm saying there are a lot of ifs in that.
Yeah.
A lot of ifs. I mean, and also if teachers, for example, saw their job also is to find objective truth and follow its lead. Oh, that's millions of ifs. You're absolutely right. But wouldn't truth be the one antidote to that kind of a locked-in syndrome?
Very much.
And I say locked-in syndrome. And what I think is happening, first, as the nation devolves into greater and greater totalitarianism in mood and law and precedent, I think of it as falling into a greater and greater state of disease. This takes me back to maybe I'm just trying to find some kind of a logical pattern or a logical approach that will allow me to find a way out of this. Profit. The news has become is seen as profitable, and therefore, truth in the news is of no matter, no value to the producers of it. But what's of value is giving the audiences stuff they want. Is that so far I've got it right?
Oh yeah, and that's well, why we have Kim Kardashian on the news.
Hmm?
And that's why you get Kim Kardashian on the news.
Oh, I don't know who that is.
it's like the latest Britney Spears or something. It's in the gossip column.
I see. Well, now so earlier you said I think it was Judy. You said something about the something roughly what you said. The culture we have has created this, decay in the media. And absolutely. And the culture we have is a capitalist culture, and that's driven in the case of, it's driven by profit motive. And so we tend. Well, and
more important is the loss motive to avoid
the what?
Financial loss or ruin.
Oh, to try to avoid avoidance motives, yeah. Right? Yeah, okay. But
loss are more important than profits.
More important to avoid or to have?
Well, they're a more important factor in winnowing out, sifting and winnowing out the marketplace.
Oh, I
by the
see.
Way, of course, I'm the libertarian capitalist here. And okay. I really object to the statement that what we have is capitalism. What we have is fascism.
Okay,
America,
sure.
Of large corporations and government.
Yeah, absolutely. But what I wanted to say, though, only simply, and then I'll shut up for a minute or two, maybe three, is that profit, whether we're going to call it the modus operandi of a fascistic state or a late capitalist state or whatever.
Crony capitalism is popular, right?
Yeah, right. Okay, yeah. Use that as well. But in any case, it's seen by and large as normal, is it not? That is a desire for profit, and not only normal, but not even shameful. But
right.
But what it
heroic.
Really, but yeah. But what it really, what the profit motive really is the disease motive.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, we got some material for debate here on the Reynolds Reveal, Eric. But okay. We will allow Eric Larson to have his say here about the profit motive as disease. Here, Dr. Judy, so call him back.
That song is so appropriate for that topic, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the morals that they worship will be gone.
What's the song?
We'll get fooled again by
Roger
who?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
if you folks want to proceed on to the next segment. Oh, I'm sorry.
His two paragraphs on this, but you know, I apologize, Judy, in that we didn't renew our conversation for you to complete the methodology order. Remember that?
Oh, right, yeah. Right. I noticed that, but whatever. If we come back to it, we might touch on that.
Okay, we might come back to it naturally, but there's no obligation.
We'll see how it goes.
Okay, here we go. We'll proceed on to the next segment here. This is getting good.
Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. My guests today are Professor Eric Larson and Dr. Judy Wood. And 9/11 and the cover-up and breaking through and allowing the truth to clean up this horrible situation we're in is our topic. And Eric Larson was saying he sees the profit motive as a disease. So continue, Eric.
I think I've just unplugged myself. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're still on.
Oh, good, great. I wonder if a person could imagine two distinct things. One being the self. Everyone has a self. That's inescapable. And as far as I'm able to see it, I'm not a religious man, for example, and my spiritual existence is very, I think, rather, it's not very spiritual. And so I see the self as the sole means that there is for people to perceive reality or anything else in the external world, that being a world outside of the self. And what is the rest of the world made up of? Well, of course, it's made up of matter and forces and all kinds of dynamics. But as far as the creatures, fellow human creatures are concerned, there's a self on the one hand, and there's the whole or the commonweal or all the others on the other hand. Now, which of the two is more important? The self or the whole? Now, the profit motive says the self is more important because and if that's
no,
the case,
Eric, it's an aggregate of individuals, and what's important is individuals and their rights, which are a respect for the common rights of others.
Well, yeah, now you're carrying it
there is no conflict here. If you have an exchange, I give you a dollar and you give me a Coca-Cola, that's mutual profit. We otherwise, one of us wouldn't engage in the exchange if we didn't both profit. See, this is where Karl Marx couldn't even figure this out. A voluntary exchange is what capitalism is about, voluntary exchange. And then it goes with divisional labor, specialization, et cetera.
Well,
trade.
Did Andrew Carnegie get rich off of voluntary trade?
Yes. Oh, yeah. He brought the price of steel, and iron and steel way down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by mass production. And he was his philosophy was you produce flat out, regardless of business conditions.
Then why did the income tax come around then?
The income tax? Well, yeah. Lincoln. I'm not sure we're on track here, but
no, we don't.
Lincoln proposed a personal income tax. You know, they fraudulently. I'm entirely against the income tax, personal or corporate.
Oh, okay.
But uh-huh. they passed this amendment in 1913, which is here. What more do you want to say about that?
Go ahead.
The statist measure, of course, a personal income tax or a business income tax. They also passed the Federal Reserve. We just celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve so we could have funny money, dishonest money instead of a commodity money, gold and silver.
I think am I still there?
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, okay, good. Okay, so I understand that my own economic view is very, very, very simplistic. But I stick with it in the sense that there is the self and there is the rest. And insofar as if you take it to the simplest level, isn't profit that which serves the self? I know you're saying
it does. Well, Eric, here's the short of that. I love you. The first word is I.
That's the language, isn't it?
That's selfish. Yeah.
Well, the language
builds. Love somebody or a principle or whatever, to call it selfish is just, for an economist, that's neither here nor there. Yes. You got to deal with human beings as they are. Now, the opposite is altruism, self-sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
That's
what
the Nazis and the communists and socialists every street.
Yeah. Sorry.
You need to update your phone, Eric.
Yeah, I can't. I don't know what to do. I can't do much.
Well, okay, Eric.
Hold on.
Can we hopscotch some of this? And
Sure. Yeah.
Back to the propaganda and bending of human minds and the
sure.
And bending of the public.
Mm-hmm. So that would take us back to New York City and what's been professed in it since 9/11. And it seems to me that that's what the Skull of York is as much about as anything. What it's producing is a state of disease. Certainly, I mean, mainly I'm a literature person, and a literary person, and I've seen the literary life of the nation has become infantile. It's paltry. It's embarrassing.
Small, right? Because they are not telling the complete truth.
It's not profitable.
No, I know that's right, but they're not telling the truth at all. They don't even have it in them. They're not even those who are producing the literary works don't even have the truth in them. They're not only not telling it; they don't even know it.
Truth has become irrelevant because it's all about profit, and so truth doesn't matter. It's not that it's good or bad; it's irrelevant.
No, it's irrelevant in the system as it now stands. But
right.
you said in the culture we have, if that's what's the culture we have, is what's created this situation. Therefore, then, if that is true, then and if this culture is producing disease and infantilism and an absurdity of mind on the very biggest, most visible kinds of literary and journalistic figures, then something's got to be changed.
As for the prophet in the news, think about it. On the day of 9/11, they all had their logos immediately. Their marketing department had already generated logos. War on Terror, Attack on America. They all had their own spin, and that was marketable. Imagine if they solved the crime in 10 minutes or so. No, then they couldn't market it. They couldn't milk it for all it was worth.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And so
okay, hey, I've got a nice little addition, Eric.
Okay.
Hold that thought, because I'm going to ask Pete to play a minute of a George Carlin monologue.
Oh, okay.
Do you have that available, Pete? I guess we're going to do it later.
Here comes.
Okay.
It actually just kind of locked up there for a second. Hold on just one second. Here we go.
Okay. A lot of things have happened since the last time I saw you. I just want to talk a little bit about that war in the Persian Gulf. Big doings in the Persian Gulf. You know my favorite part of that war? It's the first war we ever had that was on every channel plus cable. And the war got good ratings, too, didn't it? Got good ratings. Well, we like war. We like war. We're a war-like people. We like war because we're good at it. And you know why we're good at it? Because we get a lot of practice. This country's only 200 years old, and already we've had 10 major wars. We average a major war in this country every 20 years, so we're good at it. And it's a good thing we are. We're not very good at anything else anymore. Can't build a decent car. Can't make a TV set or a VCR worth the fuck. Got no steel industry left. Can't get health care to our old people. Can't educate our young people. But we can bomb the shit out of your country, all right? Huh? We can bomb the shit out of your country, all right?
Does that help, Eric? Or
no, no, no. It only made it worse. It only made it worse because it makes nothing happen. It makes nothing happen. It causes, brings about no change. It doesn't address
Eric,
the actual enemy.
But you believe that 9/11 was committed by insiders, the enemy within, and to foster profits by this means, to, you know, the global hegemony.
What you're going to beliefs?
Eric argues this in the Skull of Yorick.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you mean, does it help to hear George Carlin tell the truth about our leadership and its purposes and our economy and what it actually is, where it gets its energies? It's not that it helps me to hear that because I know it.
Yeah,
I'm not disagreeing with. But what doesn't help is to know that George Carlin is dead, and nothing happened as a result of his having lived, and there is no greater hope for any kind of reformation or humanism to emerge in the nation than there was before George Carlin. In short, he didn't find a way to get at the truth that would get past the little segments of the nightclubs that he did this stuff at. He's like Woody Allen. He doesn't.
Hey, Dr. Wood brought up the Soviet Union, and Eric Larson argues, you know, it's a pretty compelling case that the hollowing out of the republic, the intellectual life, is leading to doom, although there are outs. Like, for example, you advocate impeachment.
Well, that's old fashioned, isn't it?
It's a good. So there are positive suggestions there, but if we draw a parallel with the Soviet Union, which was established as a workers' paradise, and of course everybody quickly got cynical, and it was a police state and a horrible, you know, mass murder, domestic and foreign, and and by the time finally it after perestroika and what was the other one? Glasnost. Yeah. It's ridiculous. You know, the whole thing just collapsed. You know, the Soviet Union's there one day and it's gone the next. And now we've got traditional Russia, and then some of these former provinces spin off as independent nations, which they were before. And so what would you believe what would this collapse look like in your, conjecture? Really, 9/11's critically contributing to this, this hollowing out and the ultimate collapse of the republic. So what would it look like?
Oh, here, in our country, you mean?
Yeah.
Today, it's going to look like, is there going to be poverty like never seen before? The money is going to be siphoned out by, what was the, I can't think of the names quickly enough, by the big squid, the money-sucking squid. You remember the reference? The money fucking squid. I might be able to pin it down later, but in any case, you know,
there's going to be a breakdown. You're saying in the economic system, not just the political collapse.
Economic, sociological, certainly literary, intellectual, academic. artistic. And so what if, you know, we were talking about planned obsolescence and production of junk as a means by which to make money. Okay, so what does junk and planned obsolescence produce? I mean, couldn't you say that it produces poverty? If people have refrigerators that break down all the time and they got to buy new ones, is that good for the people or bad for the people? Well, bad, isn't it? All right, just assume for the moment that it's bad. Then what is the equivalent of junk that's produced in thinking? Junk intellects, junk intellectuality, junk think. What does it produce? Well, if production of junk produces, you know, economic poverty, then junk thinking must produce intellectual poverty. And if spiritually junk thinking, it must produce, you know, spiritual poverty. And then all those are going on now. And then if you have, in addition to it, what's been happening specifically since 2008, but much longer, the theft of money from small possessors of it to the Wall Street heist people.
Well, I can agree with you on both fronts.
That produces real poverty.
But
I'd like to add something else here. Something I realized that you have X number of hours a day.
Yeah.
And you spend it a certain way. If you spend it doing junk, that's time you don't spend doing other things.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. And
is anybody going to defend, you know, Frank Rich or Amy Goodman or all the you know, David Corn, all these New York intellectuals or, you know, plastic intellectuals, they're hollow people. They're basically liars about fundamental issues. We'll call it fundamental. And I think 9/11 is fundamental.
Sure.
If you're lying about that, what else are you going to be lying about? You're going to be lying about a lot of other things.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
But the majority of the people can't recognize the truth anyway anymore.
That's right.
Because of the junk thinking.
That's right. It's as if it's been reached a kind of, I don't know, I won't do it, I'm not going to do it. I was going to use an atomic fission metaphor, but I can't. Can't bring myself to do it. You know the one I meant? Where you achieve a mass?
Yeah.
And after that, something is unstoppable?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm not going to use
it. So are you that pessimistic, Eric?
I just don't like seeing cheap, crappy language. You know, when people say things are over the top, they don't know what they're talking about. Oh, that was good satire, but it's kind of over the top. Do you think anybody knows where that phrase comes from?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, I'm sorry. Well, World War One, trench warfare.
Over the top. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And what you do is you run. You're pushed up over the top, and you're shot. I mean, chances are you're going to be shot.
Interesting. It's like the whole nine yards, right?
Yep.
That's World War II, I think.
But, oh, is it?
Yeah.
See, that I didn't. Some kind of an ordnance or artillery.
B-17 bombers, you know, you have this long set of rounds that run through your machine guns.
Oh, use up the whole nine yards of ammo.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. Well, you know, I think it's important that these kinds of metaphors don't get simplified and popularized and used for cheap things when they're of great importance. It's a little bit like, you know, George Carlin, he'd laugh at that, wouldn't he? I would too, but it's appalling. And
well, it's like, Eric, I have a coffee cup with Oscar Wilde, I think. life is too important to be taken seriously.
Well, yes, it's wit.
that's a witty way to put it. Here's another analogy. Robert Higgs, the economist, put, and it probably comes from, he borrowed it from somebody else, but you're in a boat. Yeah, there are a lot of holes in it. even if you were doomed, would you bail? I would bail. Okay?
Yeah. Okay, so let's bail.
Yeah, we are bailing. We're doing the best we can.
All right, forward.
What did Higgs say?
Robert Higgs said, you're in a boat.
Yeah.
There's so many holes in it. You're doomed to sink.
Yeah.
And the question is, are you going to bail to try and delay the inevitable? So, well, truth is, reality is, it's not that certain, but
no,
you get the the issue here.
Oh, absolutely. And first of all, what Oscar Wilde meant by seriously was the opposite of what most people think is seriously. So he meant it was too valuable to go and be an insurance salesman or a clerk in a bank.
To keep your perspective, you have to have a light touch sometimes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You got to enjoy life. So there are some bad things, some terrible things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Today, what do people mean when they say, let's bail?
Leave, exit.
Yeah, let's jump out. I jump out of an airplane and parachute safely to ground. Or let's get out of this dump. It's just amazing. Language, it tells a lot about us.
It's very important, as you say, and we all recognize. And control of the language, therefore, is very important, is it not?
Absolutely. And so, and lies are part of the language. I mean, if you lie to yourself the way that culture is lying to itself now about 9/11, if you lie to yourself about your own personal health in the same way, it would be the equivalent of doing this, and it would cause grave disease and finally death. If, for example, you have some form of cancer and you denied it and you simply didn't accept the truth of it, you didn't acknowledge the truth of it, you didn't address the truth of it, you would get worse. You would get sick. You would die. It would be disease and infection. Yeah. And so forth. Now, there's no difference between that and living a great lie that's a cultural, intellectual, even spiritual, political lie like the one we're living now. Any more than it was for the Germans when they lived the Hitler lie.
And we're going to end the same way, too. Going down.
It's killing us. It is killing us. We are a diseased people and a diseased nation. It may not be the profit motive that is a source of disease, but if the profit motive is the cause of this great denial, then they're related. But I do know.
But the only way I could entertain that is that you both are linking the news media with profit and loss, almost truly.
I'm looking at it as a holistically, the whole culture as to what people find important. What people are directed to value, and for example, they aren't taught to question the media. You want to come to us, our network, because just believe us. We'll tell you the truth. Just believe. Don't think for yourself. We'll tell you what to think.
Yeah.
And you get a whole lot of that, and you have people who don't think anymore, and they assume that the media is telling them what they need to know, and they don't think, and they can't start thinking.
Yeah. Well, let's change the direction a little bit, or at least test both Judy Wood and Eric Larson on the following. Are there any self-corrective trends or contrarian things going on? And I have in mind, this is a little bit of a softball question, but somebody had a column in a Sunday newspaper about good social trends, one of which was teen pregnancy, for example, is declining. It's not cool as a teen now to be pregnant, and abortion is on the decline. And I'm not saying these are directly involved with, there's a more wholesome culture developing or anything to that effect. But in our context, intellectually, Eric, or on the 9/11 as destroying our culture and life. Is there anything going on? Can you point to the internet as being a safety valve or a corrective that may save us?
Opposite.
Really? Now, expand on that, Dr. Wood, of why.
People don't have to know anything. They believe whatever they read on the internet. And I've actually encountered some of those recently. Someone said, went to look up my stuff on the internet, and they saw this junk about me, and they said, "Oh, you've been debunked, so I shouldn't need to read your book because I read it right on the internet, so it's true."
Hey, I've been a victim of that too. It's sort of laughable. Yeah, it's sad.
Yeah,
but there's Eric, more and more that do that.
Eric, what occurs to you about the internet as a non-savior?
Well, I would take if the larger question you asked first. How about the social trends that are of a positive kind regarding rights and sexuality and gender and marriage of like genders and so on and so forth? Oh yeah, sure, good. But it's about as good as, say, for example, in the kitchens of the Titanic. the Cunard Line Health Association decided, yes, it was time to raise their health certificate in the kitchens from a B to an A. I mean, in New York here, we have A, B, C, D in the restaurants. As I guess you probably know. Well, so, wow, how wonderful. Think of all the health advantages and all the way that people aren't going to be so sick all the time. The food will be much more clean and salutary. Not going to have a damn thing to do with the downing of the ship, though.
Okay, I agree. So, but what about the internet? You don't see as a safety valve or an approver, or much less a life raft for the Republic.
I do. I mean, it seems to me that it is yet still a free.
It could be.
It could be. It is still technically a free internet, but you know, most of it isn't any longer. I mean, I couldn't publish. I can only publish in one place, and that's on my like websites through my own little press. I can't publish anywhere else in the nation. I can't publish in any kind of acknowledged publisher. Because same as with the internet, it's all self.
Publishing.
Not self-publishing, but the internet is self. Yeah, I can't think of the word. Self-censoring.
Yeah.
People won't tell the truth on it, and most of those who tell what they claim to be the truth are doing it for ulterior motives, like profit.
Right, and they you see people who agree with they've read Dr. Wood's book, they agree with it, but but I don't support her. No, please don't attack me. I don't support her. But I promise.
Yeah, God forbid.
Yeah, they get bombarded with junk, and so it changes them. They wouldn't dare admit to whatever.
It's not respectable, right? This whole pressure for conformity is amazing.
Yeah, it is. But also, it's not accountable. For example, if you have a printed page, and you're writing an argument on the printed page, that argument if the argument claims to be sound, it's accountable, and you can have people go back to it all the time and reread it and criticize it. But online, it's not look at that that way at all.
They don't look back on it.
They don't look back, and most of it is just lost in the ether. And it's just cockamamie. Oh, gee, who sent this to me? I read an interview with Morris Berman in the Atlantic Monthly, and I read every single comment following it. What a waste of time. The comments are just awful.
They're demonstrating what the article was pointing
out.
Saying.
Yes,
and they couldn't even recognize that their behavior, they're rejecting it. Oh, it's not true at all because... it's sort of like saying, people in America can't add today. They can't even add 2 + 3. And it's, oh, he's a liar. 2 + 3 is indeed 9. It's the equivalent of that. It was.
Yeah. And the ability of people to perceive irony is almost extinct. And that goes along with everything else that we're talking about. That has to do with looking at the thing for what it is. If a guy says, I can add 3 + 2 = 9, well, that's ironic, but it's not ironic anymore if you don't know what the hell 2 + 3 is.
But who can out-bully the other is the winner of the argument. It has nothing to do with thinking and logic.
Absolutely. Either. It's the lame and the halt leading the blind, and the blind leading the lame and the halt.
Okay, there's something else that is... Yes.
Some of this is, America's dumber and dumber type thing, but what's your experience with seemingly paid college students that you've mentioned or, trolls on the payroll to just beat down the truth, just beat it down 100 to 1?
Because truth doesn't matter anymore. It's all about, being liked by your friends and truth has lost its value.
It's not a respectable commodity any longer. Is that it?
Yeah.
I guess not. It has no currency.
Popularity is what counts, not truth. Actually, you look at the argument the truthers put on. Well, no truther respects Judy Woods, and they don't even get my name right.
Yeah, I know.
it's amazing, and no respectable truther supports it. So therefore, that proves she's wrong. What kind of an argument is that?
Well, yeah, by law of numbers, right? What we do is vote on scientific issues.
And yet none of them have read my book. The ones who have read my book have bailed out of the truther, gangs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The book will take a person away from the internet discussions of 9/11 very quickly.
Eric, I was telling Dr. Wood before you came aboard that a lot of the opposition to her work and the distortions and the whole cover-up effort had to do within the 9/11 community, truthers and researchers. And yet your work really goes to the wider popular media and elite media that you're upset with. And that's a very interesting, it's like a two-level opposition, and it's very hard, we're pointing out, and I hope it's I'm not too depressed after this interview.
Sorry.
That you've got, you got your front seven suppressing valid information about 9/11 and research, and then you've got the back four. And how do you make any progress against this kind of defense is our problem, I take it.
Yeah. And it's like you're asking a moment ago whether there's anything good happening in the nation as itself demolishes. I'm convinced that it's one at a time, that only one mind can perceive the world at a time. There may be 500 million minds, but each of them is as if alone.
They have to think alone.
That's right.
Way thinking occurs.
Absolutely.
At an individual level.
Yeah, and it's the only way perception can occur too. But that's why there's so little thinking and there's so little actual perception left, because people are given instructions by various means and over huge lengths of time, periods of time, to act as herds rather than as individuals. And so it's easier, thinking just disappears.
Even the people who've read my book, after they've read it, and they get beat up on the internet for saying anything positive about it, then they say, well, I don't agree with her theories, though. Her evidence is wonderful, but I don't agree with her theories. There's no theories in the book. The conclusions is facts, is a list of facts. She theorizes about laser beams from outer space. Huh? On what page, please? But it gets repeated over and over again to the point that people start believing that's what they read in the book.
Yeah. That's what's so pathetic about the situation now. As when I was a kid, when I was a college student, my professors, they had a lot on the ball. And if I had an opinion and it was a crummy one, a non-solid one, I would find out. I wouldn't necessarily find out by being humiliated or anything, but they were solid. They knew their stuff. They loved their stuff. They were expert at it. They didn't claim to know something they didn't know. And often they would respond to a question with, I don't know. And, maybe you will someday, things of that sort. Now I can't find anybody to appeal to as an authority who isn't a liar.
Because you don't survive in a system like that by telling the truth.
Well, you sure don't anymore if that's the case. I don't know, but I know that I can't appeal to any of the editors at the New York Times. I can't appeal to the local ones, the ones who do the neighborhood writing. That paper is so absolutely excellent at its local reporting and featured writing. It's just a pleasure to read. And as a result, I waste a lot of time on it because I read about, awful things that have happened in the Bronx. Whereas, you know, I can't get anywhere at the paper on anything.
Well, you know, how do you get promoted at the New York Times? I mean, look at the system.
Oh, read my thing. Is Dwight Garner, what is that essay I wrote? It's one of my absolutely all-time, I think it's well, how about The Pernicious Hypocrisy of Frank Rich, book part one and part two.
You're a brave man to read these people, Eric Larson. Listening to The Reynolds Reveal. We've got to take a break right now, but please rejoin Dr. Judy Wood and Eric Larson on the other side of the break. Welcome back to The Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. And if you would like to call in, you've all been pretty quiet out there. The number is 218-862-9829. And my wonderful guests today are Eric Larson, professor of English, emeritus, and novelist, and Dr. Judy Wood, author of Where Did the Towers Go? And we haven't spent a whole lot of time directly on that evidence, but folks, you need this book is 546 pages, so beautifully produced, and the only physical scientist, the independent physical scientist who's told the truth, found the truth about what happened at the World Trade Center and 9/11. And we all are well aware of the loss of liberties and rights domestically, and then the mass murder committed in the name of rooting out the terrorists overseas. And the kind of the grim assessment is in many ways well-founded, but people like me and many Americans, I suspect, still want to see that ray of light. And truth is the solvent, and then maybe there are specific mechanisms like Eric Larson has proposed, like impeachment, but that's such a long shot because we all know that the very corrupt system in which people who donate for the campaigns own the candidates and therefore the office holders by and large. And there's a trade-off. You've got to be in office here in order to do the right thing, but to be in office, often you got to do the wrong thing. So it does look like there. I remember one movie called No Way Out where Kevin Costner was the lead and trying to get out of the gun, and he knew something that the powers that be don't want out. But still, we're looking for Eric and perhaps Judy, the internet as our escape valve. But what else comes to mind, Eric, on this whole question of are we doomed?
Yeah. I tell you, your reference to the impeachment matter is, of course, that's a very dated part of my book. And when Nancy Pelosi said, what year was that? In 2006, she came back after the elections and said impeachment is not on the table.
And, yes.
Yeah.
With, George W. Bush. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was the end of, essentially, I mean, someone.
And as you pointed out, I think, Eric, you said just proposing this for this president really is a permanent bar.
That's right.
It's allowing the lawless people in office to do whatever they want.
Yeah, yeah. As a precedent, it's just sickening. Just awful.
In 2004 or January 2005, when I went to D.C. to protest the certification of the Ohio vote, where there was obvious fraud in the presidential selection, I was one of less than 50 people. That's the problem.
But isn't there a hugely important footnote in Where Did the Towers Go about that?
Yeah, I realized that they weren't fixing it.
Yeah, yeah, and I can't remember how the footnote is phrased, but you know, in my new novel, people may not be thrilled to hear. You know, I don't know how many people are going to hear about it at all. But all of the action occurs—not all of it, but most of the important action occurs in the footnotes.
I I can recite what it was in the year 2000. You know, remember at the in the 11th hour or whatever, like at 1:30 in the morning, the votes flipped. Mm-hmm. It was Gore was ahead of Bush, and then the votes flipped. And, you know, then afterwards they said, well, we call off the vote and let the Supreme Court decide who will be president. We can't fix this election. We'll fix the next one.
Yeah.
Then 9/11 happened, and then, you know, here I am doing my job. I assume the grown-ups are doing their job. You know, they're going to have an investigation. They can see what's wrong with the 9/11 thing. Right. And the 2004 presidential selection came along, and the same thing happened, but even worse. At 2:30 in the morning or whatever, the votes flipped. Mm. Or at 1:35, I guess it was, the votes flipped. And then it was obvious, okay, they had the opportunity to fix it. They didn't fix it. They're not going to fix it. Mm-hmm. Whose job is it to fix it?
Hang on. Whose job is it? Bush and Cheney weren't elected either time. They weren't.
They were appointed. But my position or my think at that point was, okay, they said they're going to fix it. They didn't fix it. Whose job is it to fix it? It's our job. It's our country. It's our world. It's our planet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the same with 9/11. That's why I decided I had to start doing something.
That's when essentially you began the book, isn't that right?
Yeah. I started going down that route because it was clear nobody else was going to fix it.
Yeah. And now that's where we are still. Nobody else is going to fix it.
It's not profitable.
It's not profitable. Absolutely right. It doesn't. It doesn't add to the disease of the nation. And so no grown up is going to do it except you and maybe conceivably me. But I can't. I don't know. I'm terribly handicapped by my own background and training, which is that each mind is an individual thing and must be approached as that, as such.
Eric, here's a related, and that is, you submitted this essay, I believe, to the New York Times about how little effect you had on maybe 10,000 English students in your courses, and maybe you came down to 2% that you had a real effect on, and it showed the impotency of higher education as an educational institution or method. And so what about that? That's part of your pessimism here about 9/11 is reaching people and getting them to think for themselves, to do their own homework.
Yeah, that's what the decline and fall of the American nation is about, the novel. It's about this guy teaching in a school where he can't reach more than 2% of the students, yet who has a president and an administration who are... We're making it sound as though it's Harvard, Yale, and Princeton all rolled into one with confetti on top. That is the school. It seems to me, I grew up in a household where outspokenness was prevalent. I guess especially from my old man. And he was a failed Norwegian Lutheran. He was a failed Norwegian, but he was a failed Norwegian Lutheran.
He became a religious,
but he never quite had the courage to do it completely. So he was still angry at Norwegian Lutheranism. If he had really broken with them, he wouldn't have thought about them. But as it was, he was still angry. So he'd get sputtering and spiteful. And he was spiteful and sputtering about that and about the school system and schools and about advertising particularly. I graduated from high school in 1959. And, the Hidden Persuaders and the, what are those books about the Detroit cars that were being built?
Vance Packard,
Insolent Chariots.
Ralph Nader, about the Corvair.
That's right. Unsafe at any speed. Yeah, and so it was the age, and this is in A Nation Gone Blind, is a big part of my preparatory remarks in there, that it was a period of American history when the meretriciousness, the planned obsolescence, the cheapness, the tawdriness, the junk culture was really revving up. And at the same time, there were plenty of people still around who could see it for what it was. And I grew up right in the midst of that. Now, it doesn't seem to me that anybody much, not very many people are around who can see the meretriciousness of everything that's around them.
But here's an example that I've come across is Macintosh computers. You didn't need another one. You buy one and it works forever. So they're going belly up because they couldn't sell more because people didn't need another one because their old one kept working. So the only way for Apple to start turning a profit was to make defective computers. Man. So that people had to get another one. That's the same thing with PCs.
That was Microsoft.
But the only way they could compete. Otherwise, think about it. If you have a computer that can last for 30 years, Apple's going to go out of business.
Yep.
Hey, I want to go back, Eric. You've seen the movie Babette's Feast?
Yes, I have actually.
That rang a bell when you mentioned, a failed Norwegian Lutheran, because Babette, basically the French girl who basically teaches these, the windswept, chilly shore of Norway with these Lutherans. It's just an arid place where nobody has any fun, it seems. Teaches them how to enjoy a meal.
What a meal.
This is really very interesting, should we say, a small movie.
Yeah, it was a small movie, but a good one. You're absolutely correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. The feeling that I have now is that there is no resistance to the prevalent culture. None. When I was growing up, I was in the midst of resistance to the present prevailing culture. That's what it was like at college. It's what it was like on vacations at home. It was what it was like with my friends when we'd sit around and, drink whatever, coffee, tea, alcohol, whatever it was. We'd be all the time on these issues, all the time yakking and arguing about all kinds of things.
Culture has to be self-critical to be guided in any kind of true path, right?
Yeah.
It's like the self-satisfied and smug and arrogant American culture with these hollowed-out intellectuals.
Oh, gee. And the hollowed-out part, I don't know. I started when I was in college. I was on this... I was obsessed with the question of whether tactile, meaningful, atmospheric, mood-setting, mood-changing, mood-recognizing elements in the culture were disappearing. Whether wood was being replaced by plastic, whether paper cups were replacing ceramic cups, I mean, anything. And, of course, I was convinced that it was just a huge phenomenon. And I wrote essays about it, which, it seems like now the ratings of a mad creature. But it seems to me that not only has that happened to a very huge extent, but lots of people have so little consciousness of mood, atmosphere, the air, the wind, the sky. Gee whiz. It's an amazing thing to see the non-responsiveness of the average person. It's a tremendous loss. And when you can't count on people to be alert in those tiny ways. For example, how ugly the country's gotten. I mean, the whole thing is one big long strip now. Big Burger Mall. It didn't used to be that way. It used to be spots of disease. Now it's disease from coast to coast. But if people...
And they don't see it because they're busy with their head down texting or,
It's gaming. Yeah, electronic editry.
Yeah.
A lot of that.
And the lack of experience from a time when it wasn't the case.
I'm a football fan and fan generally, and the new Chevy Silverado has an ad where he's got a new Chevy pickup and he takes the son. He looks to be about 12, 13, 14. Uh-huh. And takes them out into the wilderness, and it's a beautiful Western scene. And they sit by the fireplace, and the kid is starting to wake up, I didn't know this was out here. they're trying to sell you a truck, but still, there's that element of truth where the kid is busy with his head down, as Dr. Wood said, playing with some electronic. And it's pretty sad. And you got to wonder how how is this affecting the minds of our youth and youth?
There's the failure of irony again, because the ad is like Judy was saying earlier about the what was the example? I can't.
Is replacing one thing with another, and that's exactly where it came to mind. Something I realized when I first got to Clemson, people talk about, oh, these students have these computers now, aren't they advanced compared to what students used to be? I said, yeah, in place of what? You can't. It isn't you're adding on new skills; it's that you're replacing. Because you can only do so much in 24 hours.
Absolutely. But in the case of the Silverado ad, the irony is missed. And deliberately, the makers of the ad, of course, hope desperately that the irony will be missed. But it's the irony that every Silverado that's sold will diminish that great Western area by one little bit. The kid, you know.
Boy, we need a different show to hack this one over, because I'm 180 degrees there. You got to have access. I got a dirt bike, you know. There's nothing wrong with as long as you leave it as it was, you know, type thing for recreational uses of the great wide open outdoors.
I got to agree with that. But all I meant is that, you know, automobiles are not our friend in the numbers that they exist in now.
As I've got mine, But, you know, this is an imperial statement from above. It's handed down by Eric Larson, who knows what the right number of... It's like, you know, John Kenneth Galbraith used to say, we've got 300,000 service stations, and that's way too many. Well, what's the right number? That's the socialist mentality dictated from above.
Yeah. Well, you see what gets dictated. It's, you know, they take out light rail and put in automobiles.
Yeah, and they do it by deceit, too.
Yeah, that's another that's mythology, because only in the older U.S. cities is that kind of dense. You have the dense population, you know, Phoenix or L.A., the western cities, which are much lower density. It doesn't make any economic sense to have rapid transit. You know, it's the big loser. It's a huge, black forces to be sucked down with almost no benefits.
I thought they had it and it was working, and that was.
And then they took it out.
Well, it's like Dallas area rapid transit. Come on, you gotta tax the people to pour money into this thing.
Oh, but it was already there, and then they took it out.
Yeah. LA.
No, well,
It was there and they took it out.
I don't know the specifics, but LA, if you stop the bleeding, there's no way to end these political bureaucratic.
Morgan, there really is a point here that we could. I think I'm not going to be tendentious, and certainly I'm not trying to be quarrelsome. But it takes something like the light rail system in a place like LA. You say it would be, where do you stop the bleeding? And it would be no profit to try to create it. And certainly it could be impossible virtually to lure people away from their cars. But at the time when the light rail system was first implanted there and developed, there weren't cars. It was a wonderful system.
It used to be, where it's profitable, that is not resourced and therefore...
It's profitable to have cars that get 5 miles to the gallon. So that's where we're headed.
Well, if people want to do it that way, yes. That's freedom of choice. And as long as they aren't being subsidized to do it, as long as they're paying something like true resource costs.
But where does freedom
I've got an F-250 Ford, you know. That thing is 12 miles per gallon in the city and 15 on the road, you know. It's a gas hog. But we have a fifth wheel trailer to pull, on a case. Go RV camping. So if I can afford it, if I'm not being subsidized, well, what's it to you,
Well, I guess that ecologically it'd be something to me,
It's what? Ecologically?
Ecologically, yeah.
Burning
in the fossil fuels. Another
issue. You ride your bike down the road and you suck tailpipes.
I got three motorcycles. They all get 40 miles per gallon, so they probably pass your test. They have catalytic converters and all this. Yeah. Then we got a Camry. It's a four-cylinder. Gets over 30 miles per gallon. We got the one truck. And then, okay, we need to get rid of your truck, huh? Because it doesn't pass ecological muster.
Wait, is that the one that pulls the trailer?
Yeah, it pulls a
camper. Wait a minute. You said no subsidies. You said no subsidies. But isn't it that our gas prices are subsidized by our military?
Oh, I'd say on net, gas prices are higher because of our invasions overseas, you know, we'd just be better being a peaceful nation and buying on the market and producing on the market domestically, of course.
But you said subsidies.
A disaster, even from an kind of a cheap energy point of view. You can't, imperialism has never been a paying proposition. Bankrupted Rome and Britain, et cetera.
We're next.
Bankrupting us, huh?
Yeah, we're next. It's like we're at the end, capitalism is like the game of Monopoly. And we're entering the end of the game where, it's not fun to play anymore because, the ones that buy up all the hotels are the ones that call the shots, and then they change the rules. It's not a worthwhile game anymore when it becomes that.
Well, the question I suppose.
Kind of capitalism you're talking about is not the kind of capitalism I advocate, that's for sure. Because
the government
is so immense. There's no area of human life where the federal government doesn't play a major role. There's no freedom left in terms of freedom from government. I don't care if it's in the bedroom or in business. It's like a Argentine economist buddy of mine at Texas A&M. He's now deceased, but he says, the Republicans say get the government out of business. Democrats say get the government out of the bedroom. The irony, they're both right.
So how are we going to, change things?
Yeah, that's the question.
How are we going to change the breakthrough on the information front with Dr. Wood's revelations that are based all on science, sound science, and real evidence? Yeah. How are we going to do that?
Well, if truth isn't popular and if it isn't profitable, then how can it survive?
Yeah.
Well, the remnant. If we're the remnant, because where there's life, there's hope. We're just going to keep on going, right? And hope that something changes.
But just cross your fingers and hope. Hope the grown-ups fix it for us.
That's it. There aren't any grown-ups left.
Right. We're it. We're the grown-ups. We're all there is.
Yeah, and it can't be a children's revolution until the children come out of their stupors. They're in really, really strong stupors.
That's the emperor has no clothes, right? We're the child. pointing out the truth, that's considered young and naive, I guess.
I've often thought a movement of some kind would be in order, but I can't imagine.
If it does become a threat to the animal, then it gets extinguished.
Exactly, yeah. Emmanuel Sverios. Do you remember that name at all?
I do, from your book.
He was a strong, 9/11 truth man, and on the fifth anniversary of the events, he quit. I think he even left the country. He said he had never, ever, in his 20 years as an activist, ever seen anything, any movement, any association so rapidly, so thoroughly, and so completely infiltrated as he'd seen the 9/11 truth movement.
This is on page 158-59 of
The
Stone of York.
Yeah.
I found it fascinating because Seferio says, we've succeeded beyond our wildest dreams and have completely failed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's amazing, isn't it? And so he gave up.
And he says, well, because of the lies, liars, and lying. Yeah.
Yep. That's right.
Actually, you say that. And here's my assessment, Seferios writes. The reason for the discrepancy is that yet we never before have I witnessed used on such a scale and such precision as I have within the 9/11 truth movement. That is disruption, disinformation, COINTELPRO style, and so on and so forth.
But the culture we have is too stupid to recognize it.
And uninformed, and not in the news.
Yeah. They don't. What I mean by stupid is, uneducated, unknowledgeable. They don't know how to think. They don't know what to look for and how to see.
And complacent. That is to say, they're fed with very, very many, many sweets. Electronic sweets, real sweets.
Pork barrel.
Bread and circuses.
I think it is. On a scale never before imagined. That was my theme as a kid growing up was the mass society. And it seemed to me that it hadn't yet come into existence when I was just, ending high school, going into college. And every day I saw it.
Eric, are there some public intellectuals that you would praise? I can't think of any prominent ones that speak the truth about 9/11. No. We had a few showbiz people come out and say some good things about 9/11.
But look what happens to them if they speak the truth.
What does happen? I'm not sure.
Well, Jesse Ventura spoke positively about after he read my book, and the truthers threw him overboard. And he can't keep talking about it because you don't have anybody to support you.
Yeah. Hey, what happened to his show's conspiracy theory on True TV? They aren't around anymore, are they?
Right.
He makes some good shows.
Right, but and it was when he was going to when he taped the show with me on it, it got edited and re-edited, and then it got put on ice for ever, and then they revived it and were able to show something after they re-edited again, but then they took the show off the air. Enough of this.
Well, I didn't know you were on one of his shows. Did you make the cut?
It was as good as could be hoped for. They didn't mess my part up too much. They didn't say anything that was too weird. It was the thing about the toasted cars, the lack of debris. The very straightforward information. Mm-hmm. But
are those available on YouTube? I wonder those past episodes from.
Well, they were taken off, but still, you could probably find something around there.
Hmm.
People were jumping all over it. They had John Hutchison on too, and that part got really pretty butchered up. Mm-hmm. They had a laser pointer on, and then the integraph generator with a piece of paper on it with static electricity. It was kind of silly, but there was a statement that John Hutchison made that was right on target. Jesse asked him. So why are you still alive? And John puts on a big grin and says, because I'm a raving lunatic.
he may be showing a path forward, right? Maybe there's something there.
I was thinking the same, Eric, in that, what we need would be some well-produced episodes like this, or just one great 60-minute type show. Yeah. It might have an effect.
Well, so, Hamlet used craziness as his means by which to reform the kingdom, and Don Quixote used craziness to get to sanity. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what we need to do. I mean, nothing is crazier than the status quo now. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing less healthy, nothing more diseased, nothing more shot through with rot and decay.
Maybe nothing it's the lunatic you're looking for, Billy Joel would think.
Might be.
Maybe.
That's right.
The lunatics who want to think, want to be free enough to think. What do you think?
Why isn't, the American culture traditionally is individualist rather than collectivist. We contrast Japan, and ruled by committee, whereas we all take great pride. You know, if you get my name wrong, it's a big offense.
Yeah.
And you'd think there'd be more intellectual rebels. There's so much destroy here in terms of the falsehoods.
You know what I think? I think that's a really good question. And somehow or other, there's an absence of whole. I don't know if you read that long preface to The Skull of Yorick. But
I did.
Great. I mean, I don't know what you thought of it, but this whole thing about the nation suffering from a disease in which blindness is taken for sightedness. Seems to me that's prevalent throughout the arts.
I appreciate your work on the art and our culture, Eric Larson and Dr. Vicki Wood, a historic figure we can declare right now. And thank you both so much for coming on Channels Reveal.
Thank you. Thank you, Marty. Good night.
Hey, Pete, thanks for Blinded by the Light.
Oh, my goodness.
I didn't have that on the list, and I like Pete to give his innovative choices there that coincide with the content.
Yeah, that was a great show, you guys.
I have another, in a way it was fortuitous. We couldn't get Eric on at the beginning, Judy.
Yeah.
Because the first half hour, we talked about some points in the book and the responses, the cover-up. And from there, we went into these the bigger issues about the condition of American thinking or lack thereof.
Yeah, and I wish I could talk more on that, but you guys had enough going on it already. But that is I think I did, state that. That is the issue with people getting it with my book, is that, various ways they cannot see it. And I think a lot of it is that they grow up with, this is the greatest country in the world. And with that mindset, that's taken as a given. It's never questioned. They're not taught how to question. And so with that being an absolute in their mind, they can't take in anything.
You know, what's really depressing is people who bought the book and we believe them when they say they read the book and understood it. And then they relapse because somebody said,
it's all about theories about space beams. Oh, it must be in there somewhere. Yeah.
That it's amazing. That's really depressing, frustrating.
And this is what we're up against is the inability to, think through things and for people to own their own thoughts. What has been encouraged? You talked about, what about the internet? This deal about likes that people collect or friends that they collect. I don't know that. That becomes the all important issue, not content. So they aren't going to risk.
That's grading. Who's the popular professor? Sometimes a popular professor is more effective, but
when I first moved to Clemson, there was a TV ad. I'm glad that stopped soon after that. But it was talking about now kiddies. It was directed at fourth graders. You want to make sure your parents are doing a good job. Grade your parents. Aimed at fourth graders.
That is ridiculous. Yeah. Yeah.
And how would they? Oh, they don't give me enough candy. They're mean, awful people because they don't give me candy. You know, whenever I ask for it. But what? You know, whatever the story is, that's why I mentioned about pork barrel business, because that's what our government has become. Is people don't get elected unless they promise people stuff, and then, you know, it isn't what the people need. And it turns into a monopoly game of
hey, I've got to mention at the end, we never took Fetzer's name in vain, but I want to right now, you know, people who claim it's mini nukes that did in the World Trade Center. And I'm going to give you a quote. To arrive at a contradiction is to confess an error in one's thinking. And here he's got a weapon that is contradicted by all the evidence. And it's an error in one's thinking. And here's a logical. I've taught 30 years of logic, et cetera, et cetera. Well, is Eric still on?
No.
Eric? No?
He's gone.
But... one of the things that impressed me in high school was to read Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. And at one point, Chaucer writes that when the gold rusts, what will the iron do? And that's what really Eric is talking about. In other words, Chaucer had the context of the corrupt priest, okay? He's supposed to be holier than thou, better than the common people. But when they're rust, What is the iron going to do? And you got somebody like Fetzer, you know, an intellectual leader. Come on.
Yeah, why is he looked up to? People don't know any better. This is actually something that's come up in the last day or two. I saw in this discussion on the internet this two people who had read my book, supposedly. One was still sane, and the other one says, well, she comes to wrong conclusions because it has to be mini nukes. did he even read the book?
Yeah.
Her theory is wrong. It has to be mini nukes. Well, what's.
God.
You wonder what's going on?
Two errors in four words, you know, come on. It's just. Well,
but there is an issue with that why people don't recognize what a theory is versus what facts are.
I know. They can't make that distinction. It's
and so
hard to be optimistic then.
So you know, do they think that they are uncovering 9/11?
No,
you can't uncover 9/11 if you have a population that doesn't know the difference between facts and imaginations.
Yeah.
You know, I watched a documentary about a man and a woman. Now that, you know, they're in their 60s or so, but they were activists. They were war protesters during the late 60s of the Vietnam War. And the FBI were surveilling, you know, their group and stuff like that. And they couldn't prove exactly what they were doing. But they actually concocted this plan to break into an FBI office and break into their filing cabinets and pull out all the documents. And they had a treasure trove, and they actually sent it to the media and proved their point. The FBI had them surveilled and so on and so on. I'm thinking to myself, if we only knew where all the documents were stored.
Yeah, it
wouldn't make a bit of difference.
Well, I was just going to ask you, what if Snowden does come forward and say, you know what, I saw this stuff, you know, about 9/11 and who's implicated in this. And this
yeah, that, I had that thought, too, earlier. Maybe
but he loses credibility. The other guy, what was his name, the blonde-haired or white-haired guy?
Yeah, the WikiLeaks guy.
Oh,
yeah. He didn't have the guts to say the truth about 9/11. Because they lose their credibility then. They're no longer important. They're expendable.
You think he'll lose his credibility if he comes forward with 9/11 evidence?
Yep.
Wow.
Because people want the story to be this way.
Not if it's for real. I think Snowden is a lot more has more influence. Him more powerful.
I think
than
so. Him. I'm hoping so. I'm hoping, and he's actually starting to give some hints that the Saudis and the Israelis are being implicated in 9/11. And his media guy is saying that they're going to come forward, you know, and trickle out information on Israel in 9/11. So. But we can only hope.
Well,
right?
That's a barking up the wrong tree. Really, that is, you know, that's the breadcrumb deal.
Yeah. That's like, oh, you need, you know, the other story's wearing out. But, oh, we have the lie behind door number 5 now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Right. It's another rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Hey, I got to run.
Okay.
And thanks so much, Judy and Pete.
We'll catch up. Yeah. Great show. Can. As always. Yeah. Your shows are just epic. Yeah. Great show.
Hey, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Judy.
Yep. Bye.
Awesome.
Later, Judy. Bye.